The headlines this hour. Iran's president says events in Afghanistan in the past 2 decades are a clear manifestation of aggression and human rights violation. The Russian president, Vladimir Putin, says that the United States' 20-year campaign in Afghanistan had zero results and ended in, quote, only tragedies, only losses. And residents of Afghanistan's Panjshir Valley vow to defend their homeland as the resistance movement says it has repelled heavy Taliban attacks. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, my name is Amin Alami, and this is a special bulletin coming to you from Kabul. Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi says events that unfolded Afghanistan during the past 2 decades serve as a concrete manifestation of aggression and human rights violations there. Raisi said, to grasp an idea of the situation in Afghanistan, one needs to look at the number of civilians, including women and children, killed or injured since the U.S. invasion of the country. The Iranian president underlined that the impoverished nation has witnessed, quote, a silent catastrophe while under the U.S. occupation. Raisi said the history of the U.S. military presence in other countries also shows that they not only failed to boost security, but undermined prevailing calm and stability there. The president said Americans who should be answerable to their dismal rights recalled to the public are just searching for pretext to tarnish image of other countries over human rights. Russian President Vladimir Putin says 20 years of U.S. presence in Afghanistan has ended, quote, only tragedies, only losses. Putin was addressing his students in the Russian city of Vladivostok. He said the U.S. Army tried to impose their norms in Afghanistan for 2 decades. However, he added it was a fruitful practice that resulted in losses for the U.S., more for the Afghan people. The Russian president has stressed that it's impossible to impose anything on a nation from outside. He also criticized Western countries' efforts to place Afghan refugees in Central Asian states. Russia argues that militants could enter the region under the guise of refugees. Political commentator Greg Simmons says the U.S. and its allies failed to impose the Western form of democracy on the Afghan nation through military means.
Many Western politicians and commentators are less willing to make it. This idea that by spreading democracy and these kinds of things by military means, it's quite Orwellian, and it sort of underlies the failure of the whole system, because it's forcing, coercing a people, a country, to accept values and norms which are completely alien to them at the barrel of a gun. If you look, the same people in charge that have been doing these for years, including Joe Biden himself, I mean, he's had a solid history of voting for U.S. wars of aggression. So I think this is not a radical changing of their stance and their attitude, but rather a rebalancing, because the U.S. is a waning force in the globe. So they need to prioritize where they put those financial, military, and political resources, because they don't have as much as they had previously.
Qatar has urged the Taliban to ensure safe passage of those Afghans who want to leave the country after the end of evacuations of American and other foreign forces there.
We stress on the Taliban the issue of freedom of movement, that there be safe passage for people to leave and enter if they want. We hope to see these commitments fulfilled in the near future, when the airport begins operations again, and that it happens smoothly, and that there be no obstacles for anyone wanting to leave or come to Afghanistan.
The Qatari foreign minister made the remarks in a joint press conference with his visiting Dutch counterpart, More than 123,000 foreign nationals and Afghans were evacuated from Afghanistan in a Furnast airlift operations to meet the August 31st deadline. But many more Afghans are desperate to depart. U.S. officials have said Kabul airport is in a bad condition, with much of its basic infrastructure draggled or destroyed. Qatar hosted negotiations between the Taliban and the United States in recent years and was a transit point for about 43,000 evacuees from Afghanistan. The foreign minister has met Pakistani officials in Islamabad to discuss the situation in Afghanistan. The visit of high command came after the U.S.-led foreign forces ended their 20-year war in Afghanistan. Kamran Youssef has the details.
The German foreign minister is the first top diplomat from a European country to visit Islamabad after Kabul fell to the Taliban. Heiko Maas arrived in the Pakistani capital hours after the U.S. forces ended their 20-year war in Afghanistan. The situation in the war-torn country was the main talking point during talks between the German and Pakistani foreign ministers. Pakistan, that shares a 2,600-kilometer-long border with Afghanistan, is concerned about the further instability in its neighboring country. The Pakistani foreign minister has this message for the world to avert yet another crisis in Afghanistan.
This is a pivotal moment in Afghanistan's history. The international community must remain engaged. Humanitarian assistance must flow. Do not let the economic collapse in Afghanistan take place.
But the German foreign minister linked the future cooperation with the Taliban living up to the promises they have made with the international community.
It is important for us that all Afghans, even those who do not support the Taliban, feel represented by this government, and it remains to be seen whether the Taliban take this into account.
Germany was part of the US-led alliance in Afghanistan, and hence the German foreign minister was asked what lessons the West should learn from their defeat in Afghanistan.
During the press conference, the German foreign minister conceded that the experiment to impose a specific form of government through military intervention was unsuccessful in Afghanistan. For him, the lesson for the West is that military intervention is not suited if it is meant for exporting and imposing a certain system on the foreign soil.
As the US finally ended its military campaign in Afghanistan, there are questions now about the future of Afghanistan. The Taliban may be celebrating the victory over the US, but their real test has only begun. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
The Taliban have called on their opposition group in the Panjshir Valley to lay down their arms as fighting continues over the control of the mountainous terrain. A senior Taliban officials asked the people of Panjshir to stop their resistance, adding that the area has been surrounded by Taliban forces. He also said that the group has tried to negotiate for peace, but to no avail. Former Defense Minister Bismillah Mohammadi said the Taliban had launched a renewed offensive on Tuesday night, but were forced to retreat with heavy casualties. People in Panjshir continued to defy the Taliban's call for surrender. The National Resistance Front in Panjshir is leading the fight against the Taliban. It consists of militiamen and former Afghan security forces. The group is headed by Ahmed Massoud, son of anti-Soviet Mujahideen commander Ahmed Shah Massoud. Panjshir has a long history of resistance. The region neither fell to the Soviets during the 1980s nor to the Taliban during their previous rule.
I with the Taliban, they should put their weapons down. War, occupation, force were never a solution for this country and never will be. In case they want to enter Panjshir with force, they will take this pipe dream to their graves.
We are from the Popular People's Movement. Our message to the Taliban is that the gates of peace are open to them. Our gates are open to the Taliban for peace. If they make peace with us, we have no problems with any of them. If God forbid they attack Panjshir, each and every one of us from Panjshir will defend all of Afghanistan. We defended it during the era of the Russians, the era of the British, the previous era of the Taliban. We will defend all of Afghanistan and will continue to defend it.
Welcome back. The Iranian army has unveiled dozens of domestically manufactured military equipment. Authorities say that the move is aimed at boosting Iran's capability in electronic defense. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Meet Alborz, Iran's latest long-range radar that can detect any hostile aerial object in any given altitude. The Iranian domestically developed radar can track 300 targets at the same time, within a range of 450 kilometers. The high-tech equipment was unveiled on the occasion of the National Air Defense Day.
Alborz radar system is produced by our experts in Iran. It is capable of tracking any air target in high, medium, and low altitudes. Nothing can escape from this powerful radar, and even radar-evading aircrafts would be caught in the net of this advanced new radar.
Alborz radar was unveiled along with over 80 other indigenously built military hardware. Iran says the new equipment will significantly boost Iran's capability in electronic defense. And this, they say, was achieved despite all-out sanctions imposed by the U.S. against Iran's defense sector.
Despite all the restrictions and sanctions imposed on our country over the past four decades, we have managed to turn the threats into opportunities and build up our own arms arsenal. And the wide range of military hardware that you witnessed today are a result of the pressures imposed on us by our enemies.
The National Air Defense Day marks the formation of the Islamic Republic of Iran's air defense as a separate force in 2008, when it split from the country's air force. The military force says it possesses all the essential arms needed to defend Iran's skies, and 100% of the equipment, they say, are made indigenously. Iran's air defense says the country's skies are safer than ever with its homegrown military equipment. Officials here say they owe this to four decades of U.S.-led arms embargoes that have prompted Iran to stand on its own feet and become self-sufficient in the defense industry. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Bahrain's main opposition group says the kingdom's ambassador to Israel does not represent the Bahraini people. The Al-Wafaq National Islamic Society said the people of Bahrain recognize neither the Israeli regime nor the ambassador Khalid Yusuf Al-Jalahma. It added that Al-Wafaq will always remain on the side of the Palestinian nation and condemned the kingdom's normalization of ties with Israel as treason and a disgrace. On Tuesday, Al-Jalahma arrived in Tel Aviv, becoming Manama's first ever envoy to Israel. Bahrain was one of the four Arab states that normalized relations with the Israeli regime, brokered by the United States last year. The decision caused huge backlash in the Muslim world. Palestinians described the move as a stab in their back. Israeli forces have demolished more buildings belonging to Palestinian families in the occupied West Bank. The regime's bulldozers, backed by its troops, destroyed two under-construction homes in the village of Beit Tamar, east of the city of Bethlehem. This is the latest in a series of demolitions carried out by Israeli forces in the occupied territories in recent days. Israel demolishes Palestinian homes and structures on a regular basis, citing different pretexts, including the lack of construction permit. Palestinians and rights groups say that the regime's demolition drive is aimed at grabbing more land for its illegal settlement expansions. Israeli troops have shot dead a Palestinian in the occupied West Bank overnight. The Palestinian Health Ministry has confirmed the deadly shooting without providing further details. The victim is reportedly a 39-year-old man who lived in a village near the city of Ramallah. Villagers say that there were disturbances or clashes in the area at the time of the shooting. They say that the slain Palestinian was returning from work when Israelis shot and killed him. Mona Kandil says Israeli forces killed the man as he was passing through a checkpoint.
The Palestinian martyr had a Jerusalem Al-Quds documents, because Palestinians who are originally from Al-Quds hold Jerusalem IDs, Israeli-issued IDs, so he has the right to move freely from the villages and from the occupied West Bank to the lands that were occupied in 1948, Al-Quds, as well as inside Israel. However, the Israeli forces were standing at the checkpoint, and then they opened fire when they saw him entering from the western entrance of the village of Beit Awr al-Tahta. Palestinians condemned the killing of this Palestinian man in cold blood. Hamas movement issued a statement calling for the Palestinians not to stop the different forms of resistance, saying that Palestinians will continue their struggle against the Israeli occupation.
The third wave of coronavirus is surging through the Gaza Strip. Daily COVID-19 infections have been rising over the past few days. The impoverished enclave lacks many resources to combat the coronavirus pandemic due to the crippling Israeli blockade in place since the year 2007. Ashraf Shannon has more details in the following report.
The Gaza Strip has entered a third COVID wave, with over 1,300 new infections being discovered daily. Infections include the extremely dangerous Delta variant. People in the blockaded enclave are flocking to vaccination centers every day to get their coronavirus shots. The recent surge in infections and death is threatening to overwhelm hospitals weakened by years of Israeli blockade and wars. On Tuesday, over 30,000 Gazans received their COVID-19 vaccinations.
Initially, we didn't have vaccines, and soon after they arrived in the Gaza Strip, people, including myself, were afraid to get the vaccination jab. I now believe that the vaccines are safe and everyone must get inoculated in order to protect themselves and protect their families.
COVID-19 has complicated the already dire humanitarian situation in the impoverished coastal sliver, threatening the socioeconomic welfare of people in Gaza as much as their health.
Everyone must get the vaccine because this pandemic is deadly and has taken its toll on all humanity. I call on everyone to receive the vaccination jabs for the sake of their families.
Currently, there are some 12,000 active coronavirus cases in the Gaza Strip. UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund, has played a major role in providing the blockaded enclave with badly needed coronavirus vaccines.
UNICEF has been providing vaccinations to the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, and we work with the Ministry of Health and other organizations to help reach herd immunity. Over the past few days, we were able to vaccinate some 95,000 people in Gaza, which is a great achievement.
The weakness of the healthcare system makes Gaza's population highly vulnerable to further major outbreaks of the deadly pandemic.
Rights groups say Israel's illegal practices continue to compound the risk of coronavirus infection for nearly 2 million Palestinians living in the blockaded coastal strip. The measures, they say, are making it extremely difficult to combat the deadly virus. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-7 6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
The founding of two North American neighboring countries, Canada and the U.S., has everything to do with genocide and erasure of indigenous presence, as well as erasure of the horrors committed by white supremacist authorities in government, police, religious institutions, and educational systems, says Siku Alulu, writer, in an article published under the heading, Canada's Indigenous Genocide is Ongoing. Stay tuned for more. The recovery of mass and unmarked graves at former Indian residential school sites in recent weeks has released a deluge of outrage and grief across the settler colony known as Canada. Horrifying truths are being unearthed that reveal the treachery by which Canadian governments, churches, and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, RCMP, originally stole and continue to steal indigenous lands. We say recoveries because these are not new discoveries. This particular form of genocide unleashed against indigenous children has been aggressively instituted and actively concealed by Canadian governments, churches, and RCMP since 1831, when the first residential school was established in Brantford, Ontario. Genocide here is defined both as murders of children and criminal acts of negligence and mistreatment that caused deaths that could have been prevented if authorities had acted on the concerns that were repeatedly brought to government. The high death rates, inhospitable conditions, and preventable causes of death were known. It was not secret, even beyond the stories from survivors and all we heard during the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada, TRC, states Anishinaabe filmmaker Lisa Jackson, referring to a national commission that took place in 2008 in a recent social media post. It was known by the government, known by the churches, and to some degree, known by the Canadian public. We cannot pretend this is a revelation. That would also be hiding the truth. This is a reckoning of generations of criminal wrongdoing and widespread complicity in this brutal system, unquote. None of what we say here is news. Rather, it is the culmination of urgent messages that Indigenous peoples have been shouting for years across the country and the globe in myriad ways, in perpetuity. I find myself frustrated with words at this point. Tuscarora writer Alicia Elliott tells people because they so often take the place of action in this country. These are recoveries of people's loved ones who never made it home. The truth that were always suppressed and denied. The anguish that makes sense of their lives and compounded righteous rage. It
fitting that the national holidays of Canada Day and Independence Day in the U.S. were preceded by this stark opportunity for citizens to finally see the truth of their countries. The founding of these two North American neighboring countries has everything to do with genocide and erasure of indigenous presence, as well as erasure of the horrors committed by white supremacist authorities in government, police, religious institutions, and educational systems. James Baldwin described this willful amnesia in the context of slavery and anti-black racism as a sinister crime, rendering white citizens ignorant of both self-knowledge and the systematic violence that they personally reinforce. Genocide and erasure are the origins and continued modes of operation of these countries. Clearing the land for white settlement was enacted by police and government officials through the deliberate spread of smallpox in British Columbia, for example. Railroads built by Chinese laborers, many of whom were indentured, forged paths for white settlers through the provinces and shore up the country. Starvation tactics were used in the prairies to thin indigenous populations, weaken resistance, force them onto reserves, and sign treaties in which the rights entitled to the land were officially extinguished. Erasure of indigenous presence through the Indian Act and reserve system, building cities, and extractive resource projects over sacred homelands, sterilizing women and kidnapping children are just some examples of how this settler nation was built. After we shake off the emotional petrification and a spiritual shock, we recenter ourselves in understanding that not even horror writers can come up with something as sickening and culturally destructive as the realities the indigenous nations are coming to terms with now. And over recent years since TRC reports were published, Mohawk Tuscarora poet, media producer, and artist Janet Rogers shares these notes. They say, "The truth is more disgusting than fiction, and it was all brought here from over there." Indigenous voices are urgently asserting that colonial genocide and erasure are far from over. Although the schools, or as many are more accurately calling internment camps, officially closed in 1996, we continue to exist within a genocidal society superimposed upon indigenous homelands that targets women and children at unconscionable rates. Canada's aggressive institution of Indigenous youth genocide carries on to this day in the accelerated form of the foster care system that breaks apart Indigenous families and apprehends children at higher rates than residential schools, redistributing them in mostly non-Indigenous families and away from their communities. It also carries on in the federal government's refusal to cease discriminating against and violating the human rights of children by obstructing immediate access to health care and other needed resources, despite direct rulings by the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal in 2016 and 19 non-compliance orders issued since then. The institution of genocide persists in the crushing ongoing crisis of Indigenous and especially Inuit youth suicide. If it were to happen in these overwhelming numbers in any non-Indigenous community in Canada, it would be considered an absolute emergency, states Inuk writer and performer Instuk Macri. This is an emergency and it is falling on unwilling hearts, unquote. Genocide persists in the racist Canadian healthcare system that enables widespread negligence and malpractice at the expense of Indigenous lives. It persists in the extinguishment clauses that remain central to modern-day treaties with federal, provincial, and territorial governments. It persists in governments' failure to officially recognize indigenous languages or ensure access to fresh drinking water or adequate housing. It persists in the rampant systematic racism within the RCMP. This national police force was established in 1873 to suppress indigenous peoples, forcibly settle and relocate people to reserves and other remote locations, enforce the Indian Act, and of course, kidnap indigenous children. Genocide persists in the arrest and criminalization of indigenous land protectors enacting responsibilities to sources of life in the homelands. The historic erasure and fierce protection of institutionalized white crimes against humanity is finally coming to light. The callous failure to notify thousands of indigenous families of these deaths, mass destruction of records, continual withholding of records, refusal to disclose names of perpetrators, the obstruction of any accountability or justice. Colonizers bury the truth of their horrific crimes with the bodies of the precious children in this land in mass grave sites that were never meant to be found without gravestones, without ceremony, humanity, or remorse. At least in the earth, they could be held and in some way return to creation. The deliberate effort to make these mass grave sites appear invisible, like an ordinary open field, is a perfect example of Canadian nationalism. Institutionalized racism and white supremacy have been so extensively normalized as to be invisible and even trivial to most Canadians. The ongoing violence and, yes, genocide that make way for Canadian authorities and non-Indigenous society to thrive are characteristically hidden, suppressed, denied, and simply ignored. Erasure of the truth is a practice of genocide, refusing to admit actual genocide by downplaying actions that the state not only instigated but continues to protect is a practice of genocide. These systems are in need of profound scrutiny and destabilization, as absence of remorse or accountability breeds only further promise of harm. As the Canadian government, RCMP, and churches abdicate responsibility and place the onus on each other to apologize, Indigenous voices are demanding that all of them, as well as the predators and murderers in official positions at these schools, be held to account for their crimes against humanity.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Fires in Greece, Turkey, the United States. Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Thousands of activists gathered nationwide to commemorate the 58th anniversary of Martin Luther King's Voting Equality March in Washington on Saturday. They protested against curbs to voting access in some Republican-led states that rights groups say disproportionately affect people of color. Many activists view the fight over voting rules as the civil rights issue of the era. In Washington, about 20,000 marchers held Black Lives Matter flags and signs and called on Congress to bolster voter rights. Other rallies were planned in Phoenix, Miami, and several other U.S. cities. According to the Brennan Center for Justice, a nonprofit public policy institute, for this year at least 18 states have adopted a total of 30 restrictive election laws, with dozens of others under consideration. Those laws range from a requirement to have a fixed address in order to register the vote to a ban on the drive-through voting that was popular in some states last year amid the COVID-19 pandemic. The organizers of Saturday's protests denounced the legislation as racist, anti-democratic voter suppression laws and demanded that the U.S. Congress pass legislation to block such voting restrictions. In July, U.S. President Joe Biden admitted that the recent push in Republican-controlled states to restrict voting access is in contrast with fair and free elections.
There's an unfolding assault taking place in America today, an attempt to suppress and subvert the right to vote in fair and free elections.
The Democratic-controlled House of Representatives has passed two draft laws to limit voting restrictions. But in the closely divided Senate, Republicans have promised to block voting rights legislation. This is a sign of polarization in the U.S. Congress.
Well, I think you have to look at it in the context of the United States political sphere. I don't think voting or our system in the United States is particularly democratic from the very onset. You have to keep in mind that when the United States Constitution was first written, first ratified, you know, only white male property owners were able to vote or have any say in public discourse. And unfortunately, not too much has changed. You know, maybe there's a little bit more people of color, maybe there's a little bit more women, but the property owning part is largely still in effect, because you have the average income of elected officials at the federal level is so high. I don't think most people in the United States feel represented by their elected officials. I don't think they think our country is going in the right direction.
American society is plagued with racial discrimination and police brutality. According to various studies, African Americans are far more likely to be shot, arrested, and imprisoned by police than any other racial group, as they are twice as likely to die compared to their white counterparts. In addition, they are less likely to get vaccinated amid the variant spreads. On Saturday, thousands of people demonstrated in the U.S. Capitol, Washington, and in several cities across the country to demand voting rights protection.
Our country is backsliding to the unconscionable days of Jim Crow. And some of our senators are saying, well, we can't overcome the filibuster. Then I say to you today, get rid of the filibuster. That is the monument to slavery we must dismantle. That is the monument to white supremacy we must tear down.
I march because I'm tired of elected officials putting themselves first. To be honest, I am disgusted by the behavior of many of our leaders. In this country, it's easier to register to own a gun than it is to register to vote. Think about that. If you are a congressperson protecting firearms, why won't you protect the right to vote? That is completely unacceptable. I march because I want change, not just for me, but for everyone who comes next.
While some marchers carried posters supporting the end of the filibuster, others chanted about police violence toward black people, workers' rights, the Afghanistan withdrawal, and minimum wage. This is a clear message that voting rights were not the only issue in people's minds. A top Iranian official has condemned U.S. President Joe Biden for what he called illegally threatening the Islamic Republic. The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, said Biden's emphasis on using other options with regard to Iran's nuclear program establishes Tehran's right to reciprocate. The reaction followed a meeting between the U.S. President Joe Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett at the White House. During the meeting, Biden said he was putting diplomacy first on Iran's nuclear issue, but added he would be prepared to turn to other options. By diplomacy, the U.S. president was pointing to the talks in Vienna, Austria, to reinstate the 2015 Iran nuclear agreement, which was abandoned by former U.S. President Donald Trump in 2018. Biden also said he remains committed to ensuring that Iran never develops a nuclear weapon, while Iran has time and again rejected the accusation and stressed the fact that it seeks nuclear technology for peaceful purposes and not for developing weapons. Biden's threat of unspecific options came after Israel's Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, accused Iran of seeking a nuclear weapon. Gantz said military action should be considered as a plan B to prevent Tehran from accessing a nuclear warhead. That's while, unlike Iran, Israel is not a party to the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, known as NPT, and is the only country in the region to have a nuclear arsenal.
Israel's possession of nuclear warheads poses a significant threat to regional stability.
The regime has carried a bombing campaign in Syria for the past years. It has threatened Iran militarily on numerous occasions and conducted sabotage attacks against the country. And when it comes to Hezbollah, Israel has repeatedly threatened to destroy the resistance group.
They can reach out and touch Iran anytime they feel like it. The question, of course, is what will Iran do if they are attacked? And that's what the Americans have to consider. And their Israeli masters.
Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said the current U.S. administration is not different from the former government of President Donald Trump, who abandoned an international nuclear deal and unleashed the most draconian sanctions on Iran. The leader also said, quote, "Behind the scenes of foreign policy, smile and self-righteous talk, America is a predatory wolf that sometimes turns into a cunning fox. An example is the current situation in Afghanistan." Ayatollah Khamenei noted that the U.S. has a nerve to behave in a way as if it was Iran which walked away from the nuclear deal. He also blasted France, Britain and Germany for failing to live up to their commitments under the deal. The leader said the trio's obstructionism in implementing the accord is no less than that of the U.S. The leader made the remarks in a meeting with President Ebrahim Raisi and his newly formed cabinet on Saturday.
So we've got basically more of the same. We've got the Trump administration with a different face that supposedly is kindlier and friendlier, but is actually just as opposed to Iran being a self-sufficient country with a functioning economy that helps its people. This is what the United States and Israel don't want.
U.S. President Joe Biden has said that rejoining the nuclear agreement is one of his top foreign policy priorities. But he has been refusing to take any steps to bring Washington back to compliance with the accord. The Biden administration has shown an unusual urge to maintain key elements of sanctions imposed by his predecessor as leverage to pressure the Islamic Republic. On the other hand, Iran says since the U.S. unilaterally left the accord in 2018, it must first fulfill the obligation by removing all sanctions in a verifiable manner. That is, Iran is able to see the effect of the removal of sanctions in practice.
On On Thursday, the Afghan capital Kabul became the scene of carnage. Scores of people were killed after two bombs exploded in the crowd outside the international Kabul airport.
The Pentagon, however, stated there was only one bomb attack.
Over a dozen U.S. troops were confirmed to have been killed in the attack. The Daesh terror group claimed responsibility. The blast came as hundreds of people were rushing to leave the Afghan capital prior to the August 31st deadline set by U.S. President Joe Biden to fully withdraw troops from the country. Intelligence reports had warned about the possibility of attacks on the airport by an offshoot of the Daesh terrorist group, which has fought against both foreign forces and the Taliban in Afghanistan since its formation in 2015. The U.S. president vowed revenge on the perpetrators, saying the evacuation efforts will continue regardless.
To those who carried out this attack, as well as anyone who wishes America harm, know this. We will not forgive. We will not forget. We will hunt you down and make you pay.
Some, however, are questioning why the U.S. chose to withdraw from this Central Asian country at this point, and if it can continue its operations in Afghanistan without having a military base there.
I think that there are a couple of reasons. First of all, they might not have thought it was important. Secondly, they were probably preoccupied with getting out. Thirdly, I'm not sure that their intelligence is as good as they say. And I think that from their point of view, they had degraded Al-Qaeda to the point that they were satisfied with. They were not focused on Afghanistan.
The outcome of the United States' longest war has also raised questions about the success of foreign military presence in the country. More than 111,000 people have been flown out of Afghanistan since the Taliban swept to power on August 15th. The Taliban had allowed U.S.-led forces to conduct the airlift while planning to finalize their own government as soon as the American troops left. U.S. forces are racing to complete their withdrawal from Afghanistan by an August 31st deadline set by President Biden. His administration is facing growing criticism over the situation in Afghanistan and what is seen as a hasty withdrawal after two decades of military presence. Biden, however, says the U.S. has long ago achieved its original rationale for invading Afghanistan in 2001, to root out the Al-Qaeda militants and prevent a repeat of the September 11 attacks on the United States. He has noted that the aim of the war has never been nation-building, a statement in contrast to what U.S. officials used to say when the war began.
But the fundamental issue is that in many, many cases, it's not only Afghanistan, it's been Syria, it's been Iraq, it has been countries in Africa. We've intervened in South America. Basically, without any willingness on the United States' part to recognize the sovereignty of other countries. So unless we begin to deal with that, I don't think we're going to be particularly effective in dealing with groups that we conceive to be terrorists.
Over the past 20 years, the U.S. and its NATO allies maintained a military presence in Afghanistan with the stated aim of fighting terrorists. The recent incident at the Kabul airport was a clear indication that the mission was not accomplished.
The U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris has arrived in Vietnam as she continues a tour of Southeast Asia in an attempt to co-opt countries against China. Speaking in Hanoi on Wednesday, Harris said that there was a need to increase pressure on Beijing over its maritime claims in the South China Sea. She offered Vietnamese President's support to counter Beijing in the South China Sea. We need to find ways to raise the pressure on Beijing to abide by the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea and to challenge its bullying and excessive maritime claims. Speaking in Singapore one day earlier, Harris had said that Beijing's use of what she called scare tactics in the South China Sea continued to undermine what she described as a rules-based order and threatened the sovereignty of other regional nations. Laying out the U.S. administration's foreign policy goals, Harris reiterated that Washington had enduring interests in the Indo-Pacific region and aimed to counter Beijing's aggressive advances, as well as to maintain freedom of navigation. Harris sought to assure America's Southeast Asian allies that growing U.S.-China tensions would not force nations that have strong ties with both countries to choose one side of the political equation. She said, however, that Washington would take the side of its allies in all of their territorial disputes with China.
Our vision includes freedom of navigation, which is vital to us all. The livelihood of millions of people depend on the billions of dollars in trade that flow through these sea lanes each day. And yet, in the South China Sea, we know that Beijing continues to coerce, to intimidate, and to make claims to the vast majority of the South China Sea.
Well, we know that the United States has little to no regard for international law and regulations. As a matter of fact, a couple months ago, there was an article published about the United States Coast Guard being in the, I believe it was Mediterranean. Now, mind you, why would the Coast Guard of the United States be in international waters unless the United States has no desire to keep international regulations and to follow international procedure?
In response to Harris's remarks, Chinese state media decried the U.S. vice president, accusing her of interfering in regional affairs by seeking to divide China and Southeast Asian nations to prevent Beijing's economic growth. China's state-run China Daily said in an editorial that while pointing a finger at China and accusing it of coercion and intimidation, Harris willfully ignored her own hypocrisy in attempting to coerce and intimidate regional countries to join Washington in a scheme to contain China. Seems that the United States' only commitment to Southeast Asia is its dedicated efforts to drive a wedge between the Southeast Asian nations and China. Meanwhile, China has accused Washington of bullying and hegemonic behavior. China's foreign ministry said that Afghanistan was one of the many examples defining what the U.S.'s so-called world order truly meant for nations.
The U.S. can come and go as it wishes and doesn't need to seek the international community's opinions, not even those of its allies. In order to defend America first, the U.S. can arbitrarily smear, suppress, coerce, and bully other countries and without paying any price. This is the order the U.S. wants.
The U.S. sees its rivalry with China as the biggest geopolitical test of the century. Southeast Asia has seen a series of high-profile visits by top U.S. administration officials, including the Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, who visited Hanoi in late July. The visits have escalated tensions between the U.S. and China, which were already high due to a range of issues ranging from cybersecurity to human rights abuses.
The United States wants to destabilize China. China is an upcoming economic superpower. Its economy in some places has already surpassed the United States. China has a growing, the most large population in the world. It is sitting on trillions and trillions of dollars worth of important resources for modern technology. It's beginning to take a lead in the space race.
The South China Sea is a gateway to major sea routes, through which about $3.4 trillion worth of trade passes each year and contains huge gas fields and rich fishing grounds. China claims sovereignty over much of the strategic waterway and since 2014 has built artificial islands and reefs and installed military bases on them.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.